The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
So, good morning. Good morning, everyone. The one announcement I'd like to make is that we have on the counter as you go out of the front door today our annual fundraising letter. And some of you are not on our mailing list, and we would like you to look at it. The fundraising letter is one of the important ways in which IMC is supported every year. So you can read the letter from Andrea, a fellow, and myself. Please take one. So what I'd like to do this morning is to continue on a series of talks I give once a month on Buddhist ethics. In particular, what I'm interested in this series is how mindfulness supports an ethical life or a wise life. Sometimes when ethics is considered, it's in Buddhism, sometimes the bare minimum of Buddhist ethics is presented of things you shouldn't do, like the five precepts. But if it's only left as admonitions of what not to do, it's hard to see how it's a positive force on following the path of practice, the path to liberation. But I think that if instead of looking at it as rules, we look at how mindfulness practice supports living a wise life, then ethical life comes out of that in a nice way. So I've given two talks, one on the first two precepts, one on each of the two precepts, not to kill and not to take what's not given. And today I'd like to give a talk on avoiding sexual misconduct. And here in particular we find in the Buddhist tradition that what is mostly said about sexuality is what not to do. And for lay people, this precept is to avoid sexual misconduct. And then there's a list of what that entails. And if you just rely on the ancient tradition, it's the literal ways in which these things are worded in the tradition, it's mostly directed towards men. What men can do and what men cannot do. But then in the modern world, then people will adapt that to more gender-neutral languages. But it's limited mostly to a discussion of what is appropriate or inappropriate sexual partner, which is a little bit unfortunate given what a huge part sexuality is in everyone's lives. And as they go through their life, has to somehow contend with their sexuality. Even people who are asexual have to kind of somehow come to terms with that, have to look at it. It comes into play. If we live in a society like ours, which is hyper-sexualized, we have to come into terms with the sexual messages that come from our society. If we have a partner, there has to be some harmony or something, some understanding between the different forms of sexuality and sexual desires that different people have. And so it's something that people contend with in a variety of ways. And the Buddhist tradition is amazingly silent about that when it's a huge part of people's lives. I would like to believe that if the Buddha was alive today, that he would be impressed that the Buddhist environment, milieu, is very different now than it was in ancient India. That we have now a large group of lay people who are seriously pursuing the Buddhist path, doing practices like meditation practice, which for centuries has mostly been the purview of monastics. And for most of the centuries, lay people were not involved in so much in meditation or following a path to liberation, but were mostly involved in a path of merit-making. And so often one of the primary forms of merit is giving to the monastics who are supposed to be on the path to liberation. And there's a whole economy of merit, a whole practice of merit that's emphasized often for lay people. But we come here to the modern, especially the modern West, And the idea that your primary religious activity is merit-making is not going to go very far. I don't think that's so attractive to people. What is attractive is the full depth of possibility of taking mindfulness and meditation and concentration, different elements of the practice, and coming to terms with some of the deeper existential issues of our lives, our suffering, old age, death, and the possibility of becoming free, spiritually liberated. And I'm impressed by how many people there are who are walking this path quite seriously. There are, I know plenty of lay people, lay practitioners in the West, who practice much more seriously a path of liberation than most Buddhist monastics do in Asia. It's, you know, we associate monastics as being, you know, they're the ones serious about practice. But in fact, if you go to Thailand, a very small minority of the monks actually meditate. So it's kind of surprising, right? So if meditation is one of the primary paths for liberation, for the deeper practice, then the fact that a lot of people do it here, says something about what's happening here. So I believe if the Buddha was alive today and saw what was going on here and how people are practicing, he would probably have a ninefold path. And the ninth step would be right sexuality. And so right sexuality is not meant to be like the, you know, right in terms of, you know, some moralistic idea of right and wrong, but right in this, the word is samma, for that's translated as right. And usually what it means is that which is appropriate for a path of liberation. So the question then is, can we take our sexual lives and consider that how engaging in our sexuality, whatever form it might take, we can engage with it so that it supports us in deepening our spiritual life, as opposed to just ignoring its relationship to our spiritual life. It tends to be a very private part of people's lives. People don't want to necessarily share it with a lot of people what's going on there and what their personal thoughts and feelings might be. And there's a history, because in Buddhism we don't talk about it much. People kind of, you know, out of sight, out of mind in terms of spiritual life. Maybe it's not so spiritual. And in fact, I think that it's fair enough to say that in the history of Buddhism, that in Asia, that there's been very little appreciation of sexuality as being part of a spiritual path, because sexuality is seen as being a little bit unfortunate. You know, if you're really serious, you'd be celibate monastic. And if you can't be celibate monastic, it's okay to be a sexual person, but, you know, it's not quite as good, but you should at least not avoid sexual misconduct. And so it's kind of like second best. It's kind of like the feeling you get in the ancient texts and how it's presented. And certainly there's not an active engagement with it, saying, yes, here is something human beings do, and we can look at it and address it as part of our path of practice. So I think in the modern world, it makes sense to talk about perhaps a ninth step and ninefold path, because sexuality is such a huge part of people's lives. And we have a different understanding of sexuality than perhaps has happened in the ancient world. People who study kind of romantic or sexual relationships in the West point out that there was a huge sea change with the troubadours and the romantic periods in the early Middle Ages, and a whole different understanding of what relationships could be arose in the West because of that. I don't know how true these analyses are, but at least the literature that survives points to a big sea change. And it's hard for us to kind of understand how much we're part of a particular current of values and culture around relationships and sexuality that might be very different from the ancient world. And so we approach it differently. And that's so in that our approach and how we are, I think it's well worth spending some time looking at sexuality and taking it seriously as part of the path of practice. If we're going to be lay people, somehow connecting to our sexuality. I've talked to monastics, or heard monastics give talks, who are celibate, who point out very strong terms. They're sexual too. They don't involve in the sexual activity, but they're sexual beings, and some of them, as monastics, have sexual desires. And so, or they live in a sexualized cultural world. And so they have to also practice with that. It's a very intense practice for them to practice in the context of celibacy and their desires, their wishes, and what goes on. And so it's a very rich, the people who do it well say it's a very rich and meaningful way of practicing. And it supports them on the way to liberation. And I've been inspired by those monastics can be very articulate and very honest about what they're grappling with in their celibacy as part of their path. I think that for lay people, we could do the same thing. We can be as honest and direct and grapple with it and work with it so that it also supports us in this life, spiritual life. So I connected to the Eightfold Path by suggesting maybe a Ninefold Path. So one of the interesting ways of approaching sexuality as a part of the Buddhist path is to look at it through the framework of the Eightfold Path and to take each step of the Eightfold Path and apply it to our sexual life. And so we start with right view or right understanding. It's the orientation that helps us to, whatever activity we're engaged in, right view is the orientation that helps us make this activity into the path. And right view has a number of meanings, but one of the primary, simplest meanings is to avoid causing harm, to avoid causing suffering, and to look for where the freedom from the causes of suffering reside. So in looking at sexuality, one of the key then points is to avoid causing harm. That seems pretty basic. And that's one of the basic background behind Buddhist ethics and sexuality is sexual misconduct involves sexuality that causes harm, as opposed to sexuality is a particular form of sexuality. Buddhism tends not to put a strong feeling about some forms of sexuality are good and wrong. Homosexuality is good and heterosexuality is bad, or some variation of that, right? There's no need to kind of make a statement because the guideline is there being harm being caused? And that's situational, depends on the situation. So that's the basic approach to right view. But more broadly, it means looking at our life, our sexual life, from the point of view of the Four Noble Truths. Is there any suffering? Is there any grasping, compulsion, clinging that leads to that suffering? And is there a path, a way to the ending that suffering, seizing it? And I've heard Jack Kornfield ask a group of people, I'll say it this way so I don't have to ask you, how many here have not made a fool of themselves with their sexuality? And raise your hand. And, I don't know if that's a fair question. Because even if they haven't, who's going to dare raise their hand? But, more profoundly, I think, who hasn't either caused harm or been harmed through their sexual life and sexual activity? And I bet most people have. Some people, in a devastating way, maybe some of you have been raped or something horrible has happened to you or been... But to look at, is there any suffering here? For myself, for the other people involved, other parties involved. And then we look at the compulsion, another word for craving or the second noble truth. And it's very interesting with sexuality, right? Because the drive, sexual drive, can be occasionally, right, a compulsion, a very strong, very powerful. It's been said somewhere, apparently, quoted that the Buddha said that if there was any other human drive as strong as the sexual drive, there'd be no hope for us, or no hope for a spiritual life. Because, there's two things as powerful to keep us kind of preoccupied. It would be very hard to become free. But luckily we have one, and there's a lot of compulsion there, a lot of strong clinging and craving, maybe especially when you're younger. And so it becomes a ripe area for looking at the Four Noble Truths. And is a possibility of finding freedom from compulsion without having to abandon sexuality altogether, sexual activity? That becomes the big question. And I think that one of the answers that Buddhist teachers have tended to give, you can't have it both. That if you're going to really let go of compulsion and craving and desire, you have to let go of sexuality. And that is, you know, maybe we can say it's an open question. Is that really true? And one of the considerations is, and one of the complications in this issue is the whole ambiguity around the word desire. And it's used very ambiguously. So that it's tended to be understood to apply to all desire. The particular desire that Buddhism is trying to free us from is compulsive desire, or sometimes called craving or thirst. Buddhism is not anti-desire, and the people who point this out tend to say, yes, there is. The Buddha emphasized the value of having a desire for liberation. We're not supposed to jettison that. Only the desire which moves us towards suffering, not the desire that moves us towards freedom from suffering. But then the same people might say that sexual desire, that's just a bad desire to have. Not appreciating that there are many motivations behind the desire for sexuality. And there might be other desires besides lust, other desires besides compulsive craving involved in sexual expression. And perhaps the Four Noble Truths, as a guideline, as a practice, helps us to tease apart the different motivations that are behind our sexuality. So the right view is a very important beginning of looking at this, to look honestly what goes on, what motivates us, what's actually happening, what are the consequences of our actions, is there harm, suffering caused, is there compulsion? And then, since intention and motivation is so important, the second step of the Eightfold Path is right intention. And right intention is usually described in two forms, what's the wrong intention and right intention. And these two categories are very interesting in terms of sexuality. What's called wrong or inappropriate intention are intentions that are motivated by cruelty, ill will, and lust. And there is, we know, some people, sexuality is motivated by cruelty, unfortunately. It's very cruel what some people do to each other. Sometimes it's motivated by ill will or anger. And the anger can be in the background or part and parcel of what's going on. And certainly there can be lust, powerful lust, and people will do things based on their lust that they'll regret for a lifetime. It can be a very powerful force in people's lives to act on the compulsion and not to be free of lust, to be driven by lust, is often not a healthy thing to do. And then the fourth motivation that I think is very important to look at in sexuality is fear. I think there can be a lot of fear, anxiety around our whole relationship to sexuality, partners, what's done, how it's done, when, how to respond, when not to respond, and there are people who respond sexually out of fear; they'd rather not. There are people who fear for losing their partner, wanting security, wanting recognition. There's a lot of things that people want in a relationship. More than pleasure, more than relational intimacy. And so to look at the intentions, the motivations behind sexual expression or sexuality or even behind celibacy or being asexual is a very productive thing. What's motivating us? So in terms of wrong intention, is there cruelty? Is there anger? Is there fear? Or is there lust? And if there is, then the mindful approach would be to look more deeply. Not to cut it off, not to say this is wrong or bad in a moralistic way, but rather probe, explore, what's going on here? Rest into it in order to kind of unpack it and let it unfold and let it dissolve and resolve itself. And this is a very important part of the mindfulness tradition, is this, you enter into what's going on in order to resolve, dissolve, evolve with it, as opposed to just cut it off and say, I'm not going to do this. So all these kind of so-called wrong or inappropriate motivations, unhelpful motivations for sexuality, we don't have to feel ashamed of them, but we do have to practice with them. I mean, practice, go into them and really understand their depths. And then there's so-called right intention, appropriate intention, if you're following a path to liberation. And interestingly, they kind of look like the opposite of the wrong intentions. And these are, so the opposite of cruelty is compassion. So is there compassion as part of our sexual lives and sexual expression? The opposite of ill will is loving kindness. Is there loving kindness as part of it? Is there, but the opposite of lust is renunciation, letting go. So that's frightening, especially, you know, around sexuality. What? I mean, I was going along fine with this talk until Gil suggested, you know, now I have to become a monastic. So much for that. But rather than seeing it, you know, renouncing sexuality, maybe it has to do with learning the ability to let go. Because without having a deep capacity for letting go, and letting go in a way that's not repression or denial, but letting go that's freeing and healthy, then maybe we can't find a way to have healthy sexual lives. Because if there's compulsion involved, we're not free. We have to be able to let go. Take it or leave it, but let go and be open to something else. So is, and then I don't know what the opposite of fear would be. Maybe confidence, or maybe a strong sense of self-confidence or strong sense of self-worth, where we're not looking towards others for our self-worth, for our companionship, for security, all the kind of other things, kind of complicated things that we bring along with us in our interpersonal relationships or sexual relationships. And then the next step of the Eightfold Path is right speech. And the first one of those is not to lie. And probably that's one of the most important ones with sexuality, because usually when there's sexual misconduct, people usually don't want to broadcast that. Usually that becomes more secret and private. But if we live a life that's not secret around sexuality, we're willing to talk to the people involved, people we know, or we only do things sexually that we're willing to tell our friends, willing to tell people we respect, willing to tell our partner, that becomes a wonderful corrective, a wonderful protection, wonderful way of clarifying and helping our sexuality be in the forefront of our mindfulness. So we really be honest so we can look at it. The call for honesty is essential if sexuality is going to become part of our path. And how often are we honest? Even married couples who might be sexual with each other, sometimes there's not a lot of honesty about what's going on and what motivates it and what people are thinking. So the call for honesty is to make it part of the path. The next is right action. And right action in this form is usually defined in three ways. It's not to cause harm, not to take what's not given. Now that's an interesting one around sexuality. I think that there are cultures where men feel like they have a right to their sexual life with their wives, and she has no say about it. And I don't think we live in a culture like that here, but that's so blatant But there are sometimes in both directions, in all directions, sometimes one couple who feels a certain right or, you know, feels like, and so it pushes, there's aggression as part of sexuality, which is not taking what is not given. And then no sexual misconduct is the third, so that's been covered by all this anyway. The next is right livelihood. So I don't know exactly how we're supposed to fold that into. This is, look at sexuality, but you know, it probably applies. You can think about it. And then the sixth step of the Eightfold Path is right action, right, right effort. And this is a complicated kind of way it's usually formulated, but it basically means avoid, make effort to avoid causing harm, and make the kind of effort that helps you become free. Avoid the efforts that are unskillful, and do those things to cultivate skillfulness. But those things which are skillful, interestingly enough, are sometimes defined by inner states of being. States of being like the seven factors of awakening. Cultivate mindfulness. Cultivate a strong sense of investigation. Cultivate joy. Cultivate tranquility. Cultivate wisdom and cultivate equanimity. So in terms of sexuality, do these things like mindfulness, investigation, effort, joy, concentration, tranquility, and equanimity, can they have a role in it? What would it look like if there was we were established in a strong state of calm or a strong state of inner joy that wasn't dependent on pleasure? Then maybe there's less need for sexuality to be about pleasure, and it can be about something else. And I think that in terms of a spiritual path, if it's only a matter of pleasure that we're looking for in our sexual lives, that we're probably not going to find much spiritual freedom there. So if we find something else, other qualities, peace, joy, tranquility, equanimity, perhaps there's, then it's easier to fold it into a spiritual life. The next is mindfulness, next factor of the Eightfold Path, and that seems pretty basic, a lot of mindfulness. Mindfulness of our motivation, mindfulness of our beliefs, mindfulness of our emotions, the whole gamut of them. I believe that our sexual expression, sexual lives, is one of the most complicated psychological things human beings do. And sexual expression is one of the most complicated forms of communication that human beings do. And it involves a tremendous amount of conditioning and beliefs and psychology and feelings and emotions. And, you know, it's not a simple thing. It's seldom just a matter of pursuing pleasure, the very basic aspect of it. And so to be mindful is to begin unpacking all the complexity that goes into it. A complexity that some people would rather not look at because it just, you know, just makes something so complicated that can be done so simply. And so, but to look at it, you know, really unpack it, then it can become part of a spiritual life. And then the fourth, that last, the eighth step of the Eightfold Path is concentration. And concentration is kind of is synonymous with calm. But more importantly, it's synonymous with a state of profound well-being, profound sense of integration, a sense of being unified or composed or whole is the goal of concentration practice. And this seems to be, would be really invaluable if we want to be involved in sexuality, because if we feel not whole, if we feel broken, or if we feel afraid, or feel, somehow in psychological pain, then we come to our sexuality with all kinds of needs based on that feeling broken or feeling not whole. But if we feel whole, if we feel a sense of stable, sense of well-being that concentration practice gives, then I would say that we come forward into our sexual relationships with a very different motivation, very different presence, very different way of being. Because then we're not looking for sexuality as the thing that's going to make us feel better. We already feel well. And if we already feel well, then it frees up sexuality to be able to, sexual expression, to come more from some of the more healthy or appropriate motivations if you're on a path of practice, which brings us back to right intention. So we can look at, is there some compassion and loving kindness in the relationship? Which means, partly, do we see the person, the full person there? And is there care for the well-being of the person that we're involved in? Or is it only caring for your own pleasure, you know, what it is for you? So I think that if these steps of the Eightfold Path are seriously applied to this part of our lives, then our sexual life can become a very meaningful part of the path of practice. I think it also, when it separates out, helps us to separate out desires which involve something like lust from desires which involve perhaps expressions of affection, expressions of caring, expressions of love. And the idea that sexuality is a form of communicating love as opposed to a way of getting pleasure, fulfilling sexual desire, I've never seen in any Buddhist text. And maybe that's because we live in a post-romantic period or something, where romance period, where we have other ideas of what's possible in relationships. But unless we are able to distinguish between these different kinds of motivations for sexual activity, then I don't think we can really find a path to freedom. And we can't free ourselves from a little bit the burden of the Buddhist tradition, which didn't really have a lot of understanding, or maybe almost no understanding, about how our sexual lives could actually be an active and beneficial part of our spiritual life. Make sense? So, what do you think of that? It was simpler before.
I have just one little
question. So, if you can use the mic, please, so everyone can hear it that way.
Something I remember a therapist told me is that sex is a gift to your partner, and that should be looked at that way.
Yeah, so that's beautiful things. So have it be our whole life, hopefully, is a gift to our partner. We can give ourselves in many ways.
So, as you were speaking, so sexual energy, powerful. It does other things besides be involved in relationships with people. It drives artists, for instance, to create things. It's involved in their creation. There are objects that are very sexual, like cars and motorcycles.
Wow. I've been missing out.
Probably not. The way people dress themselves. Yes. So there's a whole range of things. Yes, and I guess my question is, how does all of that fit into
I think it applies directly. I think your point is well taken. We live in a sexualized culture. A lot of things are sexualized. There's erotic energy. And you know, it's interesting that the term for avoiding sexual misconduct literally is not limited to sexuality. It's literally avoiding a misconduct of the senses. So sensual misconduct, and so that could be, you know, don't have misconduct with the food you eat, you know, or So I think it's what I said can all apply to any situation at all. So if you're dressed in a sexual way because you like being sexual and just feel good, maybe you're a celibate even, but you just like dressing in sexual, suggestive ways. It's beautiful, it's erotic, it's joyful and nice, and you celebrate that part of your life. I can imagine that could be for some people. But use the Eightfold Path as a schema to look really what's going on here. Is there any suffering, craving, compulsion as part of that? What's the intention behind it? You know, and if you're really mindful of all this and look at more carefully, look more deeply into the phenomena, what's actually happening? So I think that I don't want to limit my discussion about sexuality to actual sexual activity. It applies in so many different areas of our lives. And also, there's plenty of people who are asexual, some out of choice, some not out of choice. But even if people are asexual, being asexual is a way of being sexual. And there's lots of things to explore there as well, if you want to make it part of the path. And so to explore, you know, you don't have to have a partner in order to explore this part of one's life. Is there a woman who wants to speak? Or just the men?
I just wanted to say that I've been coming here for more than a decade, and in one of the early guests, you had a guest one evening, and a female, and she said, you know, whenever you hear a Dharma talk and the word chocolate comes up, it's code for sex. I just wanted to say thank you for taking the wrapper off. And
I see. And in the 10 years...
It's just nice to... It's actually nice. It's nice to be in a relaxed presence with what's been going on.
Great.
So I just want to acknowledge my thanks. And
thank
actual relief,
oh, good.
In a way,
yes.
That we respect this most important topic.
Great. Thank you. And I don't think I've talked about chocolate.
It wasn't you.
Next time, chocolate. So one more person all the way in the outer hall, and then we'll stop.
Regarding right livelihood, I would guess not profiting from sex or sexuality.
Why?
Well, specifically sex trade or, you know, imprisoning women or kidnapping them and making them sex slaves.
That goes without saying, yes.
But perhaps even if you think about all our commerce, it's based on selling sexuality. And that I think, has led to a lot of problems in our society.
I agree. Tremendous problems. And it breaks my heart to know what goes on in the whole sex trade thing world. And there is, you know, an interesting conversation to be had, exploration about whether selling one's body for sexual favors, is that unethical in and of itself? Or is that a person's right to be able to do that? And is it, you know, is there a dignified way of doing it? In the time of the Buddha, there were courtesans who seemed to have had very valued and dignified roles in the society of their time. And in fact, one of the last people to make a big donation to the Buddha in terms of land for a monastery before he died was a courtesan named Ambapali. And the Buddha had a conversation with her. He went to her house for a meal. It was... You know, and I think that she was kind of maybe, you know, expecting to get paid for whatever services she was providing. So is it absolute that it's a wrong livelihood to do sexuality for money or not? I don't want to answer the question, but I want to raise it. But probably given how much suffering there is in our life, we should probably err on that to say, yeah, we shouldn't do that. You want to say something more since you brought it up? I think it's an important point.
I was thinking also about the fact that we sell products by selling sex.
Yeah, that's terrible.
And that drives more desire.
Exactly.
More consumer desire.
Yeah,
and competitiveness. And these competitiveness.
Children, these poor children who grew up with all that, and they're getting this message of that sexuality is what it's all about, and they have to present themselves this way in order to get their way in life. And I think we shouldn't use sexuality to sell things. So I said we'd stop after one more. So and that, it's time. So we have our tea today. So if you are new, especially, please know that you're very welcome to stay and hang out. They set out tea in the other hall there. And people here are friendly. So, if you're new, you can just turn to someone near you and say hello, and they're happy to say hello and introduce themselves to you. Okay, thank you.